This is Breakpoint This Week, a weekly briefing on faith, culture, worldview, and mission with John Stonestreet, president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview.
Well, welcome to Breakpoint This Week. Glad to be back with you after a hiatus last week. Back here with Warren Smith. Warren, you had Shane Morris, one of our writers, join you last week. Did a great job. You guys covered a lot of stories, but it's good to be back.
Yeah, he did do a great job, but John, it's always great to have you back.
You're obligated, I think, at some level to say that. So I thank you for that kind of somewhat.
Well, it is sincere, though. It is heartfelt.
Well, listen, I find myself, as we were recording this, just having spoken to a group of about 600 pastors and student leaders in Delaware, which was a lot of fun, but I'm mindful of my home state, which I may or may not be able to get back to tonight, including my family, who are kind of in the bullseye of what a crazy blizzard out there, and one that's kind of probably wreaking havoc on travel. I'll know more a little bit later on today, but it was really something.
Yeah, I think the entire country has been horrified, entertained. Sometimes it's hard to know which word to use because it is horrifying, but on the other hand, at some level, you can't take your eyes off of it, of trucks being just blown over by the wind and the snow drifting up. It's a pretty remarkable sign of the power of nature and of nature's God.
Well, listen, one of my favorite things that our former previous co-host, and I'm tempted to say something sarcastic here about Ed Stetzer, but I love Ed, and one of the things he always talked about was, you know, when these sorts of things happen, look for the helpers. And, you know, that was something that Mr. Rogers said, and it's something that I've really started to apply. And believe it or not, I was on the phone trying to help a young man who was stranded on the side of the road, and just basically created this network of total strangers who were able eventually to reach him after 5 or 6 hours in this blizzard. And what I was moved by, Warren, was just the fact that, you know, this guy that I had never met, I talked to him on the phone, hopped in his tractor and tried to get this kid and wasn't able to, turned around, and he was in the vicinity, which, of course, we found out because of our technology. You know, one of the best and worst things in the world is the ability to locate anyone at any given time. And he was able to flag down his neighbor down at the end of the road, who was finally able to get the guy in to some warmth, about to run out of gas after about 5 or 6 hours, you know, being buried by snow and hit by 65-mile-an-hour gust of wind. I mean, it was just amazing to watch these people. In fact, the guy who alerted me about this kid's situation was in another state on the East Coast.
Wow.
So, I mean, it was just this strange sort of surreal incident. And he texted me the next morning and said, hey, thanks for helping. And I'm like, you know, tell your friends thanks. I'm like, they're not my friends. Like, I've never met them before.
Yeah.
And they turned around and you know, we're talking about 5 degrees removed from knowing anybody. And they still came out and helped. And that's what you see in some of these situations. It's really an amazing thing.
Well, it is. And I think it's important to tell these stories, John, you know, because as you know, because our Wilberforce weekend has a theme, is Christianity still good for the world? And the reason we pick that theme is because, you know, for the last 50 or 60 years, the evangelical church has been really focused on, is Christianity true? But what the culture seems to be asking is Christianity good? People like Rodney Stark in his books, The Rise of Christianity and others, really talks about how Christians have always been the helpers that you mentioned. They're the ones that have run towards the plague. They've been the ones that have run towards the fire. And I think the moral of your story is that Christians are still doing that. We just don't do a great job of telling those stories, and certainly this mainstream secular media doesn't do a great job of telling those stories. So it's really exciting, and I think what the church has always done, and it's great to tell those stories.
And I think it needs to be said, actually continuing with my theme of, I don't know these people who listened to my call and helped this kid. I don't know if they're believers. I kind of got a sense that at least one of them was, and they were contacted from some friends who are believers. But, you know, I remember Eric Metaxas saying this years ago, you know, we no longer debate about whether to help the poor. We now debate about how to help the poor. And that's a major move forward into goodness. And historically, if you look at Rodney Stark and others, it's not just that Christians doing the good. It was the Christians putting that idea that we should do good into the world. Mm. And, you know, the idea of compassion, the idea of hospitals, the idea of running into tragedy instead of running away from it. That we take it for granted, like that's just what people do. But that's not just what people have always done, and that's not something that you see across cultures and civilizations. And you certainly see Christians with the capacity to do things that are wrong as well. But it is something that has a source historically, and most people would point it to Christianity. By the way, I think it's good, too. We're talking about the story of people doing good things. You know, given the big story midweek of this kind of college admissions scandal, and my kids have been addicted to Full House for a long time, so it's kind of hard to think, Aunt Becky, you know, what did you do? You know, was one of the actresses that was caught up in this really incredible story of a lot of money changing hands so that kids could get into college.
Yeah, about $25 million is the latest number that I've heard. About 50 people have been indicted and others have been implicated. It's possible that there could be more. You know, John, in some ways, though, this just reveals a dirty little secret of the college admissions process that has been going on for many, many years. And that is, if you've got the dough, you can go to the show. And it's an important story on all kinds of levels. I mean, if you're a parent or a grandparent and you've got kids that either are or will in the next few years come of college age, you know, this is a story you need to pay attention to, because it's an indication that people with privilege, that people with wealth can game the system. It's also, I think, John, a story that helps us bring into focus how a Christian worldview can help us sort out ethical problems when it comes to not only the college admission process, but many other challenges we face. So, for example, clearly it's wrong to bribe a college official to get your kid into school, and yet people with privilege would pay for their kids to take the SAT course multiple times or do SAT prep courses. I would argue that one of those is clearly unethical and one of them is not unethical. But where do you draw the line? How do you make these decisions? And I think your Christian worldview can help with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, most of the coverage of this story has been on, you know, which celebrity's kid went where and which school has been implicated. And there was actually an organization that was set up, you know, to fake test scores, to fake athletic careers. I mean, that was crazy. Elite colleges often will hold admission spots, you know, for, you know, sports like crew or fencing or, you know, things like that. These aren't high profile athletes, but it's kind of a guaranteed admission. And this organization would literally pay coaches to give scholarships to kids who had never played the sport, and the college coaches would walk away, you know, with money and so on. But so that's where most of the coverage has been. It's just kind of the salaciousness of the details. But look, this has been going on for a long time. On Breakpoint on Friday, we walked through this. In a sense, these parents got a pretty good deal because, you know, some parents have spent millions of dollars in quote-unquote donations and, you know, guaranteed their kid an admission spot, you know, through the development department. And that's been going on for years. I mean, that's not uncommon. I mean, how many movies about college life have that as a, you know, a sub-story plot? And there's no question about it. But one of the things we said, Warren, you go to the Christian worldview point of it, is to me, this is like another example of what happens when education gets untethered from a Christian vision of what it means to be human. That's a long way to say the Christian vision of the image of God, the idea that we're able to know, that learning is a spiritual activity, it's an act of worship, that it's something that everybody shares as part of their collective humanity. This was introduced to the world by Christians. Christians had that idea that education was something not only for the rich, not only for the privileged, not only for the, you know, the upper caste or the upper class, but for everyone. And not that they always did it or they always did it well, but the idea owes itself, again, to a Christian vision of what it means to be human. And now, I mean, it seems like from top to bottom, the whole educational enterprise has just about become exclusively utilitarian. You know, you go to college to get a job, to make money, to buy stuff, to retire, to die. But the whole vision of education as attaining wisdom, becoming a better person, this is all gone. So I guess to me, it shouldn't surprise us if the whole system has been captivated by utilitarianism, that a utilitarian ethic wouldn't drive the admissions process too.
Well, I think that's right. And, you know, John, one of the things that was a part of the story that I thought was also interesting is that, and again, what I'm about to say could be misinterpreted, so I want to be careful, is that nobody was paying tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars to go to the local community college. They were paying to go to, in most cases, fairly elite schools. And it just kind of shows you what kind of social capital that you can accumulate by going to these elite schools, that the colleges have become, in some ways, a finishing school, a networking experience for kids to enter a certain stratus of culture. And it has created almost a two-class culture. I mean, we don't have the kind of caste system that countries like India have, but we really do have a class system here that this scandal has brought into sharp focus.
You're listening to Breakpoint This Week. If you want to check out that Breakpoint from Friday on this whole college admission scandal, come to breakpoint.org, click on the link on the homepage. It says resources mentioned on the radio and podcast, and we'll link you to that article where we kind of explore the Christian worldview foundations of education and what happens when education as an experiment gets untethered from that. I'm John Stone Street here with Warren Smith. Stay with us.
Hey everybody, I'm Warren Smith. You know, for 2,000 years, Christianity has been a force for good in the world. But these days, lots of people wonder if it still is. That's why the Colson Center's Wilberforce Weekend is so important. The theme of this year's conference asks the question, is Christianity still good for the world? Now, of course, we think the answer to that question is a resounding yes. And we'll be making the case so you're equipped to make the case with your family and friends. This year's Wilberforce Weekend takes place just outside of Washington, D.C. on May 17, 18, and 19. I'll be sharing the platform with philosopher Dr. John Lennox, author and hip-hop artist Jackie Hill Perry, musician and novelist Andrew Peterson, former Atlanta Fire Chief Kelvin Cochran, Pastor Rick Warren, and many more. To find out more or to register, go to wilberforceweekend.org. I look forward to seeing you there.
Well, we're back on Breakpoint This Week. John Stone Street here along with Warren Smith. I think we're kind of in this good news rotation. So I think it's good news time again, Warren. Interesting decision that was passed in Ohio in the Circuit Court of Appeal. Ohio had passed legislation to defund Planned Parenthood. That had been overturned by a local court, but the U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals just this week said that they can do that, that Planned Parenthood doesn't have, quote, a right to perform abortions. And so therefore, Ohio doesn't have a right or an obligation to fund the organization. It's really a fascinating opinion. And, you know, I think more evidence of a number of things. Number one is that this is really a kind of a seesawing sort of time when it comes to abortion rights in America and the pro-life movement. I think the long-term investment in the courts are very interesting. The majority opinion was written by a George W. Bush appointee. And four of the 11 judges who sided with Ohio in the ruling were appointed by President Trump. And, of course, that's one of the stories of the Trump administration is reworking the judiciary and not just at the Supreme Court level.
Yeah, I think that's right. I was particularly taken by that political article, John, that you cited that said that four of the 11 judges in the majority were Trump appointees. I mean, that is, love Trump or hate Trump, there's no doubt that those four judges made a difference in this case and that they were Trump appointees. I was also wanted to note that there were a couple of organizations, Ohio Right to Life, that had been actively working on this issue, and that an organization called Americans United for Life, which is an organization that's not as well known as some of the other pro-life organizations, but some people call it the law firm of the pro-life movement. Americans United for Life will often file amicus briefs in these cases, and in fact, they did in this particular case. And apparently, that kind of education and activism made a difference.
Well, and it stands in stark contrast to what we're seeing around the country, right? I mean, we're seeing the New York bill, which, of course, we all have that memory of New York legislators cheering basically a bill that would allow abortion at any stage for any reason. And, you know, the Freedom Tower lit up in pink. And then, you know, the Virginia debate, which did get defeated, but Governor Northam's comments. And then, of course, that went to Rhode Island. And also New Mexico defeated a bill this week that would protect babies from late-term abortions. I mean, it's just amazing And then you got Tennessee and Georgia passing bills that would protect unborn children from abortion after they have a detectable heartbeat. I mean, look, it all goes to what one of the things you and I have been saying, and we've been saying at Breakpoint for a long time, is that overturning Roe v. Wade is a goal, but not the final goal of the pro-life movement. It's going to go back to the states if there is some level of where Roe v. Wade is questioned or overturned or anything like that. And these states are shoring up where they stand. And you've got conservative states that are pushing it back to heartbeat level. You've got liberal progressive states that are basically going towards, you know, infanticide. And people are unashamed on both sides right now. I mean, there's been a level of clarity that's been brought to this debate throughout all of this. I mean, we're not using euphemisms like the right to choose or safe, legal, and rare. I mean, we are, but it's not at the same level of kind of muddling the debate right now. The issue right now is crystal clear.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, as you said, John, the clarity has been striking and in some cases shocking. I mean, you've got celebrities who are talking openly about being proud of their abortions. I don't know how that's even possible, but they are doing it. And it just shows you that whatever stigma or lack of clarity is disappearing. And, you know, while we celebrate the Ohio decision, as you said, that this is good news, bad news story. And you mentioned something of the states like New Mexico and Tennessee and Georgia that had passed laws this week. Another interesting development is that the Trump administration put regulations in place, an executive order that would defund Planned Parenthood, not completely, but about $60 million. California immediately sued, and that created an injunction against these regulations, or could create an injunction against these regulations taking place. Oregon also sued, and they were joined by 20 other states. So between California, Oregon, and the 20 states that joined the Oregon lawsuit, you've now got 22 states on the pro-abortion side. So as you say, the dividing lines are becoming very clear, very sharp, with some states on one side and some states on the other. And these issues are likely going to be tangled up in the courts for many months, if not years to come.
Well, you know, we talked about the physical blizzard that took place in Colorado, but, you know, there's been since the new legislature has been in session, there's been an ideological blizzard that has just completely changed the landscape. Colorado legislature has been on the fast track to a progressive agenda that would, you know, rival California and Washington State, I think, in many ways. But one of the interesting things that I'm seeing here, and it's happened on the abortion side, it's happening on a number of other issues as well, is how things have changed. And what I mean by that is not just on ideas, but I mean conservatives were the ones talking about states' rights and the importance of state activism. And, you know, we're trying to get our conservative colleagues involved, you know, at the state level. And we kind of felt like the left was really pushing things through the Supreme Court and through the legislature. Man, that's kind of reversed. I mean, it's like progressives have suddenly become federalist, you know, in their vision of how to get things done. I mean, the state-level activism since Trump really became president, and especially since the midterms, it's just interesting to watch that happen.
Well, it is interesting to watch it. It's hard not to be cynical from where I sit, as you say, that the liberals suddenly become federalists. But of course, I think they're not really becoming federalists. They're doing what they're doing purely for pragmatic reasons. But I would say on a more positive side, or at least an object lesson here, is it just shows how important these state elections are and these local elections are. I mean, we so often, John, as you have done over the years, and as Chuck Colson did before you, he would say that we're strong in America because we're strong in the middle, not because we're strong at the top at the culture centers like Washington or New York or Los Angeles, but we're strong because we're strong in our local communities, in our local churches, and in our local city councils and state legislatures. And you're seeing now just how true that is and how important it is for Christians to get involved in city council races and county commission races and school board races, because that's where a lot of these important decisions are going to be made now and in the years ahead.
I was reminded of that this week, Warren, just being in North Carolina with the North Carolina Family Policy Council and in Delaware with the Delaware Family Action Group. You know, these are groups that are mobilizing statewide efforts, mostly around policy and politics, but not always. And of course, this is the vision behind the Colson Fellows program. That's why we continue to see Colson Fellows regional cohorts planted around the country. I think we're going to be up to 18 next year, probably 300 or so Colson Fellows studying with us, you know, figuring out how to be engage the culture wherever God has placed them, whether it's vocationally or whether it's demographically or geographically. And that was the whole vision. It's not just the professional's job to go to D.C. and Hollywood and do all the work. The work has to be done in every neighborhood and every backyard, building up those mediating institutions of church and family, bringing a Christian influence to bear wherever culture is built. And, you know, that's really what the Colson Fellows program is about. Come to ColsonFellows.org. We're taking applications right now. If this is something that kind of sparks your imagination, join this movement. It's a fantastic group of over 1,500 individuals who have been trained to think clearly about culture, to go deep on Christian worldview, and you can join that whole process. Well, you're listening to Breakpoint This Week. I'm John Stone Street here with Warren Smith. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You can learn more about Breakpoint and the Colson Center for Christian Worldview when you visit breakpoint.org. That's breakpoint.org.
Well, back on Breakpoint This Week, here with Warren Smith, I'm John Stone Street. You know, there's a lot of stories this week, Warren. We're not going to be able to get to all of them. But it's a story that happened this week, but it's really part of a recurring story that we're seeing over and over and over again, where comments that were made 10, 20 years ago are being brought back up and thrown at celebrities. I mean, not just celebrities, but political leaders. Governor Northam's comments, for example, something that he did back in college at a time and in a place where, yeah, it would have been edgy to do what he had done, but not the same level of complete condemnation that is part of today's culture. And for better, I mean, you know, there's no room for any kind of racism in our culture, and there shouldn't be. Tucker Carlson, before he became one of the most popular Fox News hosts, did a lot of calling in to some radio shows, a lot of which were kind of good old boy radio shows. And you're from Charlotte, Warren. Probably a couple of those were based out of Charlotte. I think I remember. Wasn't there a John Boy and Billy show?
Yep. Absolutely. The John Boy and Billy show based at the Big Show, as they call it.
The Big Show.
Based in Charlotte, North Carolina. Yep.
Is that still going on?
Absolutely, it is. Though I don't listen to the typically the radio stations that it's on. Occasionally, when I'm traveling and I don't know the radio stations in a local town, I'll flip around the channels and find them there. And yeah, absolutely, they're still around.
Man, I remember catching them outside of Chattanooga. And to be clear, that's not one of those shows that really pushed the line. I mean, we often think of guys like Howard Stern and, you know, there was a guy called The Grease Man. But these were the sort of shows that I think Tucker Carlson apparently made at least more than one appearance on as a guest. And a clip that surfaced said some things that, you know, just off color.
Yep.
And there were two sets of comments. Let's be clear. The first set, I'm trying to remember what the first set even was. In context, probably not as bad as the way it was pitched. The second set of comments, however, were directed towards Miss Teen South Carolina contestant. A lot of these contestants were sexualized. There's, you know, the bikini contest, basically. This was kind of viral because this contestant answered a question in a really incoherent way. Do you remember that, Warren?
I do. Yeah, it was. I felt for her because, I mean, there's no question that she was completely incoherent. She was a deer caught in the headlights. But, you know, John, you and I are now talking on the radio, and I'm not saying that we're great at it, but it does take some skill, and it does take some presence of mind and some preparation. And, you know, she was a young girl put in a tough situation. She messed up. The problem is she messed up on national television and became a laughingstock.
Yeah, she did. And so they were laughing at her. They were making fun of her. But then there was a quick turn to sexualizing her.
Yep.
And talking about this. And we're talking about, you know, a teenager. I mean, it's really unacceptable what was said. Something you and I would never once said about our daughters. Hopefully, if we heard anybody talk like that, we would call them out. And there's two questions that emerge from this. Tucker Carlson responded to the initial criticism with basically, you know, go back and read it and make sense of it, and not really an apology. I haven't seen a response to the second set of allegations yet, so I'm not sure how he's responded. It just seems – it's amazing how far, I think, just a clear mea culpa, I was wrong, I shouldn't have said this, forgive me, would go. Now, I don't think it would get Tucker Carlson off the hook because I think he's part of the right and the progressive left and controls the media to a level where there's, you know, it's you get forgiven on one side of the aisle, you don't get forgiven on the other side of the aisle. I see that over and over and over. Yeah. And that's the reality of it. But why can't we just apologize? Why can't we just confess? That's an important thing that Christians need to be able to do.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, John. And I, even though I know Tucker Carlson and I like him in some ways, what he said was beyond the pale. It was wrong. He should have just apologized. And I still wish he does that. But I think you're right. We are in such an environment that even apologizing is becoming tough to do if you're a public figure, because if Tucker apologizes, a lot of his supporters will say he caved, that he gave in, that he compromised. And a lot of his political enemies will use his apology against him. There's just so little good faith in the conversations that are taking place in the public square that it makes it really, really hard. Now, I want to be clear, I don't think that should be an excuse. I think that when you make a mistake, you need to apologize. I can tell you that as a journalist, whenever I write something that is an error, I write a correction if I discover it later. And so I think that doesn't give us a pass on not apologizing, but I do understand why it has become so hard.
Yeah, it's just something we just need to go back and remember in a time of, we know that it's going to be an unpopular thing to do on one side. It's going to be used against you on the other side. Yeah, Tucker Carlson can't win. We're going to get hate mail saying, "Stay, you know, don't turn on our guys." I get all that. My point, though, is if we said something wrong, we say we were wrong,
yep,
not because it will go over well, but because it's the right thing to do.
Absolutely.
And it just seems to me like a million times in this cultural moment, we got to learn to walk and chew gum at the same time. We can't be guilty of the drunk uncle dilemma of, you know, letting our people off the hook because they're our side. Now, again, I don't think the left has treated this fair. I don't think the left does treat this fair. It also, by the way, brings up a whole an interesting conversation, and this is something I really struggle with, and is there a statute of limitations on these things?
Yep.
Now, if somebody doubles down on their comments, then obviously it's no longer a past issue, it's a present issue. But you think about, you know, do we really, David French has written interesting things about this over the last couple weeks. I mean, do we really want a culture where instead of debating ideas, we're just digging up dirt on each other from 20 years ago? Now, some dirt needs to be dug up and it needs to be revealed. And if it turns out to be true and somebody doesn't own up to it, and I mean, this all becomes part of the calculations. But man, it is a very difficult culture to live and to relate to each other in, if we're basically one that just consistently looks 20 years in the past to find things to hang over our heads.
Yeah, I think that statute of limitations question, John, is a really important one. And I actually think an important consideration in answering that question is what you just said. To what extent is the person repentant? To what extent has the person apologized? To what extent has their life since they did that thing that was so wrong been different, which is, of course, the evidence of true repentance? So I think that, as you say, especially for people in the public eye, the people for whom we depend upon their character to be of a certain level because they have a position that requires character, I think we should look into their past. But on the other hand, I think that if they made a mistake 20 years ago and they were truly sorry for it, it was a one-time thing that they've lived a life over the last two decades that is evidence of that repentance, I think that we should have a very different posture towards that person than someone who has attempted to cover it up and when it is revealed, doesn't apologize.
Yeah, there's a number of factors in the equation. I think we can learn from the Apostle Paul. I mean, I was the chief of sinners. I think we can learn from Chuck Colson, you know, who just acknowledged that power was seductive and it corrupted him. But in Christ, he was a new person. And just acknowledging it is just a huge step forward. This is going to be an ongoing conversation. We haven't solved this problem.
Nope.
in this discussion. And there will be another story probably next week. So keep joining us on Breakpoint this week as we talk about the issues and the stories and culture from a Christian worldview. Come to breakpoint.org, click on the link on the homepage that says resources, mentioned on the radio and podcast, and you can find different articles and commentaries related to the things that we talked about. For Warren Smith, I'm John Stone Street. Thanks for joining us on Breakpoint this week.